a man by the name of Charles Dudley Warner, who was a friend of Mark Twain's and who had a congregational past like ours, wrote once that no man but feels more of a man in the world if he have a bit of ground that he can call his own. However small it is on the surface, it is 4,000 miles deep, and that is a very handsome property. Well, we have a bit of ground we can call our own. Huge machines last week bit down into that 4,000 mile depth we own and scooped out the basement for our new church and leveled the parking lot where Billy and I stood on Friday and tried to identify all the cars parked there in our imaginations. It is a thrilling sight. It makes our three-year dream seem very, very close. For now, we are in this place where we truly became a church, and we are happy for the presence of every single person here, member or visitor.
This morning, Valerie would like to say something to you.
Hi. As you probably already know, we're in desperate need for Sunday school teachers for the fall. We have 75 kids in the Sunday school now, ranging from ages 2 to 17. And because of this, we've expanded our Sunday school. We're adding one more class, and we're also adding one more youth group, which will be ages 6th grade through 8th grade. So right now, we're really in need of 8 teachers for the Sunday school and one more sponsor for this new youth group. And we also need one more vacation Bible school teacher. And I really need these by about August 24th so that I can have a meeting with the teachers. And Sunday school starts on September 7th, which is the first Sunday of September. And I'll be leaving the 1st of September, too, so I want to get this all in place so that when Nancy takes over, we'll have Sunday school in session. And we need your continued support so that we can have our Sunday school for the kids. Thank you.
There is a young lady present whom I will not identify, who often hears my son preach in Oklahoma City. And I understood this morning that she told her parents she had heard one of his sermons that I had preached. And I explained to them, and will now explain to her, that was one of my sermons that he was preaching. I know that hurts, but actually, he tells me that he takes my sermons and greatly improves them. And I believe that. They are also improved, I think, in the delivery because he's younger and better looking. We pick each other's brains, Debbie, constantly, all through the week. So if you shuttle back and forth between Mayflower Church in Oklahoma City and University Church in Wichita, you will sometimes hear the same ideas being talked about. I'm an incorrigible dreamer, so I will confess that when I see a handsome young man like Dusty Slater, part of the John and Kim Caraway family, reading so well to you, I look ahead about 10 or 15 years and see him and young men and women like him as leaders in our church. And that delights me. I can hardly imagine a writer, a poet or novelist, who does not keep a notebook so that when he needs a memory, he can find it. I can hardly imagine a preacher who does not keep notebooks where she can record the way life illuminates the gospel. Then there is the wish to share some of it with friends, as I am going to do this morning. Here are some gleanings and gatherings from recent weeks. People talk about the sacred as if it were something quite set apart from the ordinary. They talk about whether they should wear a hat or not wear a hat in this or that sacred place. They are hushed and solemn in special rooms, boisterous under the open sky in God's great room. Well, every year I find myself less inclined to make these distinctions between the sacred and the secular. I read with ever-increasing delight people like Lewis Thomas and Lauren Isley and Annie Dillard, who write about the most ordinary things and leave them bathed in the light of holiness. A swollen river, a snail's strange life, animal and human eyes locked for a long moment when it seemed to the poet naturalist that a mysterious harmony hung between them. More and more I want to see with their eyes. These people who get a double magic from seeing the ordinary as extraordinary, who find themselves knee-deep in miracles when I am only seeing a world of the commonplace. I want that twist of focus that suddenly brings the holy into view where I thought there was only the prosaic and the mundane. I don't know whether you have read any of the Father Brown detective stories by G.K. Chesterton, but the reason that bald, unassuming little priest was always so successful was that he solved the mystery by means of the most everyday, commonplace observations. He saw ordinary details invested with more meaning than the casual lookers. Children, I know, do this all the time. I walk with Tanner, who is 3, and if I am to do that without spoiling it for both of us, I have to stop frequently while he bends down to examine a worm, a bug, a colored stone. Tanner is fully alive. I remember that the church father, Irenaeus, many, many centuries ago in the early times of the church, celebrated that kind of awareness. He said, in fact, he shouted it, "Human being, fully alive, such is the glory of God." The kind of life I chose required me to learn to do things quickly, and the quickness brought many good things, but one of my keenest regrets is that I did not slow down a little more often. I read an essay called An Entrance to the Woods, in which Wendell Berry described how he made himself open to the mystery that is all around us. Rushing by interstate highway to a retreat in the woods one weekend, he was keenly aware at first of his dis-ease on entering the threatening silence of the woods. He slept restlessly. But by morning, his mind and body had begun to forget the highway and the dissonance of the previous day. He lay in the sun on an outcropping of granite, and in his forgetting was also an anamnesis, a deep remembering. Something, I suppose, about where man came from and how briefly he had been upon the earth until he became one with the silence around him. There is a pilgrimage of forgetfulness by which the ordinary begins to show itself in new ways. Captain Ahab, in Melville's Moby Dick, said one time, "All visible objects, man, are but as pasteboard masks. They point sacramentally to mysteries behind them." Storytellers and poets understand this better, I think, than most preachers. There is a story, for example, about a man who came from far away to study under a great rabbi whose wisdom was celebrated. When the visitor reached the village, the people asked him with pride if he wished first to hear their great rabbi read the Talmud or to pray. He said, "Neither. I only wish to watch him cut bread or tie his shoes." They never understood how the visitor could simply watch the rabbi sitting absently in thought in the light of the afternoon sun and then go away edified. It is a true miracle to see a wise man lift the mask of the ordinary and reveal a marvel no one else had noticed. More and more, I think the contemplation of any ordinary thing made extraordinary by attention and love can become an occasion for catching sight of God. G.K. Chesterton again suggested one time that, and you need to listen to this carefully, it is a good exercise in empty or ugly hours of the day to look at anything, the coal bucket or the bookcase, and think how happy one could be to have brought it out of the sinking ship onto the solitary island. Do you follow that? What I take for granted becomes, in another light, a sacred object. It is a matter of seeing, and one can learn to see. If you were to say, what is one of the things you would most like to teach us? I would answer that the holy is everywhere. I should have learned that sooner than I did, because here and there in the Bible, some nameless author wonders where he could be and not encounter the holy. Whither shall I go from thy spirit? Or whither shall I flee from thy presence? For that man, it was impossible to be where God is not. You would not object if I called this a sacred place, because people through the years have sung and prayed and heard scripture and sermon here. But I remember a Sunday morning a couple of years ago when I stood alone on top of a mountain in Oregon, watching the rising sun and thinking of you meeting here in this room and knowing that I was in just as sacred a place as you would be. I worshiped as truly there as I have ever worshiped anywhere, though differently. I never was quite so taken with Alice Walker's novel, The Color Purple, as some of my friends, but Shug Avery says a wonderful thing once in that book. Everything want to be loved. You ever notice that trees do everything to get attention we do, except walk? We haven't the time to notice. I came out of the cancer center at Barnes Hospital in St. Louis one day a long time ago. After 2 or 3 hours in rooms where life was going out in ways I hadn't even been able to imagine before. Some moments you never forget because they change the way you look at things forever. And I will never forget that day. I came out into the bright sunlight, holier than I had ever known sunlight could be. There was a huge old tree nearby. I stooped down to touch, caress the grass, the simple grass, for a moment. And then I walked over and put my hand on the tree. And I felt the miracle and mystery of life and holiness and the sacred and the intermingling and interpenetration of all of it as never before in my life. Those simple things, taken for granted, became a symphony. I worshiped beauty, and I worshiped the commonplace. I heard a whisper I had not always heard in church. The ordinary can be a mask for the holy if we approach it with reverence. Our trouble is that we want to lift up the edges of the ordinary so that we can get a quick look at the glory it hides. And so we keep looking beyond all the simple things without seeing them for what they are. This day, we say, is not so much, but wait until tomorrow. Tuesday shows me no glimpse of God, but wait until Sunday. This ordinary face in my house is nothing but, oh, the face of the rabbi, the priest. The most stunning moment, perhaps, in the Christian story is that moment when Christ puzzled some people by thanking them for feeding him when he was hungry, for giving him shelter when he was homeless. "But we never fed you," they said, astonished at his praise. "We never came to comfort you in some illness." His reply is classic. "Oh," he said, "if you did those things to any ordinary person, you did them unto me." In other words, every person we meet, in some strange sense, is Christ. Do you need a moment to think about that? I know how crazy it can sound, but it is, believe me, part of the divine madness of the Christian gospel. There are people locked up, I know, who think they are Christ. But there is a world of difference between what they claim for themselves and what Christ claimed for us. "See me in every person you meet," he says, "and the world changes." Well, it would, wouldn't it? How can we despise ourselves, as we sometimes do, if we are a mask for the holy? How can we despise our neighbor if she is? Religion can be so pompous. It yearns for marvel and mystery and sensation. "You want a sign," Jesus sighed. "You want me to give you a sign." He was wearied by that, knowing that the signs are all around, that we only need to learn how to read them in that amazing play of Shakespeare's called King Lear. So profound and rich, it almost frightens me sometimes. There is an unforgettable moment when the old king, wise at last, speaking to the daughter Cordelia, whom he had once rejected, utters his final eloquent plea for prosaic mystery. Now, before you hear it, please run that paradox by your attention one more time. Prosaic wonder. A contradiction in terms? No. A truth beyond truth. A journey into the deepest heart of things. So we'll live, Lear says to his daughter, having come tragically too late to wisdom. So we'll live and pray and sing and tell old tales and laugh at gilded butterflies and hear poor rogues talk of court news, and we'll talk with them too. Who loses and who wins, who's in, who's out, and take upon us the mystery of things as if we were God's spies. The mystery of things, of common, ordinary, everyday things all around us, masked by the familiar, but whispering the name of God to those who can hear it. Years ago, I read the ancient Gospel of Thomas, one of those long-lost biographies of Jesus that did not make it into our New Testament, but that nevertheless has some splendid moments in it. Listen to this one. Split the stick. Now, there's a commonplace action for you. Split the stick, and there is Jesus. Do the most ordinary thing and find it full of wonder. Well, it is only partly true, of course. Split the stick without the right attitude, and it is only a broken stick. My backyard tree, the wonder of my children, do not reveal the face of Christ unless I learn to see beneath the mask. Do we understand now why Christ said to his literal-minded friends, if only you had ears to hear? Well, they could hear a call to dinner. They could hear the call of a friend. They could hear the noise of traffic. It was some deeper hearing. If only you had ears to hear, if only you had eyes to see the reality behind what you see. Now let me finish that verse from the Gospel of Thomas. Split the stick, and there is Jesus. Lift the stone, and one finds the Lord. Shall I bring it closer home? Tell you how a few days ago I split a stick by accident, lifted up a stone, and found the holy face of God? I heard you say yes. I was in Oklahoma City to help my son do some work. I think he told this story last Sunday because I said to him, that's a marvelous story. It has to be part of a sermon. But he beat me to it. So if that one person here has already heard it, hear it again. I met a little boy named Fletcher Baldridge, favorite playmate of my grandson, Blue. I thought it was tough enough just to be named Fletcher in Oklahoma City. You know, Bob or Tom or Red Feather, but not Fletcher Baldridge, with that exotic flavor of aristocracy and old England But the name was not this child's only burden. Fletcher was 8 or 9, and physically very awkward because of a terrible car wreck in which he had been thrown through the windshield. He has an enormous ridge of scar tissue down the middle of his chest and stomach. And on one side of his throat, a plastic tube where the carotid artery used to be. Somehow, though I do not understand it, he was changed in the trauma from being left-handed to being right-handed, and he isn't well coordinated anymore. I want you to see him walking a little awkwardly, but with the most sensitive and handsome face you've almost ever seen on an 8 or 9 year old boy. And he's bright, just as bright as he can be. He puts sentences together with a precision that I'd like to find in some of my college students. He's creative and imaginative, and he likes the games Blue likes, so they've become great pals. As I watched them on the floor one evening while we waited for dinner, I asked Fletcher if he'd like to be a soldier when he grew up and use one of the guns they were playing with, and he said, "Oh no, I would not wish to be a soldier. I do not like it when people are violent. I would not want to be violent." You can begin to see why Fletcher is an oddball at school, where most of the kids think he is a freak. He can't run well, so in the competitive races, he messes up things for his team, and the kids laugh at him as he lumbers in about 50 feet behind everybody else. Fletcher is learning about a lot of things besides English and math. One day when Robin came home from work, he jumped out of his car and yelled for Blue to come give him a hug and kiss. Robin completely forgets the rest of the world sometimes and doesn't care if everybody in the block hears it. "I want a hug!" Blue, who gets all the hugs he can use, was in no hurry. He had something else on his mind, and he rejected the invitation, at least for the moment. But Fletcher was there playing that day, and Fletcher saw this happen. I don't know what was in his head, whether he felt sorry for Robin and wanted to substitute for Blue, or whether he forgot everything but the great hunger in his own heart. What I know is, he walked over to Robin and looked up. "I sure would like a hug, Mr. Myers. I don't have a daddy." God is love. Look behind a face this week and find him.